Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we have a really great and important show for you today. I'm thrilled to have with me, I think for the first time ever, an intern who is going to be an anesthesia resident. She's in a categorical program, so she really is already, but she's in her intern year. And so we're going to talk about the application process and matching and applying in anesthesiology. And nobody could be more expert on this than my guest who just went through it and very successfully. Her name is Dr. Tricia Pendergrast. She is an intern at the University of Michigan Department of Anesthesiology, and she'll be in their anesthesia CA1 through 3 program in the next 3 years. And we're going to talk about a really interesting survey that we did together along with a colleague, Mike Hoffkamp, asking applicants from this past match cycle to answer a bunch of questions. And Tricia is really taking the lead on this, and she's going to be able to tell us a lot about what we learned as well as informed by her own experience. So I am thrilled to have her on the show. Tricia, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I should have asked you beforehand, but am I pronouncing your last name correctly? Is it Pendergrast?
Yes, there's a lot of consonants, but you're doing a great job.
Awesome. All right. Well, congrats on your match and on becoming an anesthesiologist. It is becoming, as we all know, harder and harder, more and more competitive. So I think this is going to be a really important episode for people who are thinking about applying and also for anyone who's advising people who are applying. Because this is information people need to know. But let's start about with you. Tell us a little bit about you, your interests, how you got where you are.
So as you alluded to, I recently matched into anesthesiology. I am an intern at the University of Michigan. My medical school education and my college education actually both took place at Northwestern in Chicago. And my professional interest and sort of area of expertise involves digital media scholarship for physicians. So I serve as a social media ambassador and a digital media ambassador for some Society of Critical Care Medicine journals, as well as the Journal of Anesthesiology. I'm very passionate about working with physicians to improve their voice and optimize the way they communicate online. I think we have a lot of influence and power there. And I'm very excited to be on your podcast today. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. I am thrilled to have you. And, you know, this is, I think, such a, I would guess, of course, I don't know, but I would guess that 10 years ago, there was not such a thing as a social media ambassador, right? But this is such a new but important aspect of what we do. And I'm so glad we have someone who's as expert at it as you to kind of help us learn about it and think about how we can do it. Now, as you and I discussed beforehand offline, we could and probably should do an entire another episode on social media and what it is to be a social media ambassador and how that plays a role in our careers and learning, which we can do another time. But for now, we're going to talk about, and part of how that plays in here is that your expertise and you being involved in these social media platforms has allowed you to get a lot of information from people who just applied. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. I have a TikTok account actually where I receive daily questions from either medical students who are interested in anesthesiology or applicants who are going through the process right now. And there is such a need for mentorship. There are a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of people communicating their experiences to me, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And that I love this because, you know, as I said, 10 years ago, this just wasn't possible. I mean, the only way you could have even gotten this information would be if somebody had the wherewithal to kind of find your email and send you an email, or, you know, you sent out a survey and hope people responded. But this is really a way that people very easily can find people like you who are accessible, who they can ask these questions of. So tell us a little bit about your own, and again, this, of course, you could talk about this, I'm sure, for hours, but, you know, what are some of the highlights and salient things for you about your recent experience going through the application process and the match?
So I had a wonderful time interviewing. I met so many amazing people along the way, other applicants that I still, you know, talk to, use social media to connect with, actually. But before all of the interviews and before the application went in, I remember a lot of stress, of unanswered questions, because even in my application season, which was not the most recent one, it was the one before, there was this period of metamorphosis that we were sort of entering into as a field. And that was, of course, in the setting of step one going pass fail, the new emphasis on step two. And so I think there was a lot of advisors and mentors who just didn't know how to guide us and how to encourage us to use the program signals because they were so new too. And I kind of felt like I was flying blind. But once all the applications went in and the interview invitations started coming out, it ended up being a really positive experience, but, you know, quite frightening. The stakes are very high, very expensive. So there's a lot of stressors that were involved that I still remember to this day and empathize with those who are going through the process now.
Yeah, fabulous. And I really think that it's so generous of you to have made yourself available on TikTok and I think other platforms as well to answer these questions. Because first of all, you're a very busy person. Being an intern is not an easy job. But there's just nobody better. This is kind of like how when I have my CA2s and they're wondering, like, what's it going to be like to take CA3 call? And, you know, I tell them, listen, there is nobody better who can answer that question than the current CA3s, right? And so it's the same. Like, if it just have to be you, because of course you can't answer questions from the thousands and thousands of people all at the same time. But most people applying, not all, but most, I think, probably have people in their medical school who applied the year before. And I always tell our medical students, like, don't let them leave here before you've had a chance to sit down and talk to them. And we always have a post-match panel where the people who just matched can give advice to the next group coming up. But I think that's just so, so valuable. So, yeah. Go ahead.
I agree with you.
Fabulous. So let's talk about for medical students, let's take, you know, junior medical students, MS1s, MS2s, even MS3s who are thinking about anesthesiology, and they're realizing that this is now an incredibly competitive field. And, you know, the data I've heard is that anesthesiology is now up there with things like dermatology, neurosurgery, orthopedic surgery as being one of the most difficult fields to match in. That may or may not be exactly accurate. I don't know, but that is certainly what I have heard. And if it's not quite there with dermatology, which just doesn't have a lot of spots, it's probably getting close. And so I'm wondering, if I'm a junior medical student and I'm thinking, listen, I'm pretty sure I'm interested in anesthesiology, what should I be keeping in mind to set myself up to have the most successful application I could possibly have?
I feel the anxiety that this is going to engender in medical students. So I just want to make the point of, yes, it's very competitive now in anesthesiology. I would put us in sort of the middle to high tier of competitiveness. So whereas the dermatology match rate for USMDs last year in 2023 was 71%, the match rate for anesthesiology was 83%. Orthopedic surgery was 74%. So we're in that range, but not as competitive.
That's good. I'm actually thrilled to hear that, because I think you're right. We don't want people to think that there's no hope.
Right?
So,
exactly.
Good. All right. So it's not quite as bad as I made it out to sound.
But it's certainly no longer, I feel like the stories I've heard from a lot of seniors or young faculty is that this is a specialty that people tended to stumble upon quite late in medical school. They would do an elective rotation halfway through third year and realize, wow, this is a great specialty. I don't think this is a specialty where you can prepare an application successfully 4 months before ERAS anymore, unless you are very well connected and very lucky. And so for first and second year medical students who realize it early, I think they're at a huge advantage. One of the things that we saw on our survey, which I'll continue to reference throughout the podcast, is that there was a significant relationship between class ranks and step two scores for applicants into anesthesiology. So students that perform better on boards and perform better academically did better in the match. So if you're a first and second year medical student, I remember the tendency to want to do research and shadow and volunteer and fill up that resume as quickly as you can. And I would encourage those students to slow down, to take a breath, to remember that now ERAS limits the number of things you can put in the activity section, first of all. But it's so important for you to get your feet under you academically before moving on to all of those other things you have to do to prepare for residency. Because if you cannot figure out how to study as an M1, how to balance all of the different commitments in your life, how to prepare for your board exams, everything else is not going to matter. And so that's what I consistently tell first and second year medical students who are wondering, what do I need to do, you know, right now, December of M1 to prepare? Once you feel like you've gotten a good handle on that, I think a really great next step is to get into the operating room, to find an anesthesiologist at your institution who will allow you to shadow them for a couple of days to see if you truly like the field or if you just like the idea of anesthesiology, because there are a lot of incorrect perceptions, as I'm sure you know, that people have about our field. And it's important that you know what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah. So I think those are fabulous suggestions. I think it is unfortunate but true that the single biggest thing in an application these days is your step two score. And so we just can't, you know, be in anything but honest about that. And so I say the same thing you say to people is that if you could only do one thing, prepare, study, do lots of practice tests, because if you don't do well on step two, really nothing else matters, unfortunately. And just so people know, you know, because it's possible people who are early on in this process may not realize why that is. It's not because we all think that step two is going to tell us who's going to be the best anesthesiologist. It's because at the moment, and I hope in the future this changes, but at the moment, their first part of your anesthesiology board exam, which is called the basic exam, you have to take at the end of your PGY2 CA 1 year. And if you can't pass that, then you can't graduate residency. So it doesn't matter how good of a clinical doctor you are, you cannot graduate residency, which means that you will put in some number of 1 to 2 years of anesthesia training after intern year, and then potentially have to leave. And none of that will count for anything. That's horrible for you, and it's not good for the programs either. And so programs have to be able to get some feel as to whether people are going to be able to pass that exam. And so that is what it is. And you just really need to know that and to prepare as best you can to do the best you can on that exam. So that's huge. And then, as you said, class rank also, if you have it. Now, a lot of schools these days don't give grades or have any class quartiles or anything. So you may not have that as an option. But if you have it, then certainly that is really, really important. And I completely agree with you. You could have 100 wonderful activities, and if your step two score is 220 or 225 or whatever the kind of low end of passing is, then you're probably not going to match in anesthesiology, regardless of how many activities you did.
Right. And then the addendum that I would like to add to that, to my answer, is that if you are a non-MD student, if you are a DO student, you should do everything in your power to get connected with mentors, to get involved in your state anesthesiology society, to get involved with the ASA as early as possible, because, and this is just the reality of medical education in this country right now, there are a significant number of resources, home programs, advising, home rotations that are available to allopathic students that osteopathic students just don't have access to. And when it comes time for letters of recommendation for those senior electives, the DO students are getting squeezed out of some of those opportunities because the field is getting so competitive. So establishing that early mentorship is incredibly important for everyone, but especially for osteopathic students who are interested in the field.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. All right. So one thing that comes up a lot, and I'm sure you get asked about this too, is away rotations. So we know in some other fields, I know, for example, ENT, ortho, I think you can't even apply if you haven't done away rotations. That's traditionally not been true in anesthesiology, but what do you think? Who needs to do an away rotation? Should everybody think about it? How do you advise people about that?
So I'm going to preface this by saying that I did not personally do an away rotation, but a good number of people in my class did at the University of Michigan where we matched. And if I were to apply this year, I would do an away rotation. Away rotations are interesting. And again, I'm going to bring this back to A, our survey, and B, the osteopathic versus allopathic question, because MD students, when we do away rotations, a lot of the time we're doing them out of strategy and we're doing them to optimize our chances at matching at a competitive program. Whereas osteopathic students are doing them out of necessity because they need letters of recommendation and they need the clinical experience in anesthesiology because they don't have a home program. And this is one of the main contributors, in my opinion, to the disparity in match rate that we see between DO and MD students. It's not about, you know, any sort of academic differences or accomplishments. It's truly a matter of resources. In our survey study, we did ask applicants how many away rotations they completed to see if that was associated with match percentages. And we, interestingly, so there wasn't a significant difference, but 63% of our matched applicants had completed at least one away rotation, whereas 48% had not. So I don't want to draw conclusions from, you know, a p-value that was not significant, but it does seem like there were more match students that did at least one away rotation. Because of program signaling, because of the shrinking number of data points that you've already alluded to, I would encourage people to consider doing at least one rotation for anesthesiology. I don't think it's necessary for everybody. If you are someone with some research experience, strong mentorship, you perform well in step two, you did well in your clinical rotations. I don't think it's necessary. But as I've heard from mentors and applicants from this past season, there are a bunch of people who had no red flags, who were set up for success and didn't match. So I, like I've already said, I think the field is changing. And unfortunately, because, and I say unfortunately, because the way rotations are expensive, I would encourage every applicant to at least have a conversation with their mentor about whether or not they think an away rotation is a good idea for them this year.
Yeah, I think that's an important conversation to have. I agree. I think that as a program director, and others might disagree, but I think that an away rotation is a gamble. That's how I always tell students. And this is why. It can override almost anything. So if you have a relatively unimpressive application, but you go and you knock it out of the park in an away rotation, that program is overwhelmingly likely to rank you to match because they know you. They have a month of personal experience. And if you were just an incredibly good rotator, that is probably the most valuable thing they could have. But you could be a very strong applicant. And if you go and you do poorly, or and that doesn't have to mean that you would be a poor resident. It could be that you may be someone who is wonderful, but you take a little while to warm up. Maybe you're a little shyer, you're a little more introverted, and it takes you a little while before you can really shine. Unfortunately, that's not what away rotations are conducive to, right? You really have to be able to, on day one, start impressing. And so if that isn't your personality, you might be able to really impress over 3 or 4 years of residency, but maybe not in just a quick month and only maybe working with a given attending or resident 1 or 2 days. So yeah, that might be a risk there. And then the other thing is that there's always a possibility, right, that something goes wrong. You say something, you get misheard, you know, somebody takes offense, but you don't even know what happened. And so there's always that risk. I agree with you that I think if you go and do well, you're going to be able to really make up for other deficiencies potentially in your application. But just keep in mind that if you're that, like you described, if you're that glowing applicant who's kind of got the, you know, the 270 on step two and the 3 first author, you know, publications and the PhD and the, you know, president of every club they've ever been a part, right? If you have the kind of just standout applicant, you don't need it. And it's maybe not worth the risk. The other thing that I think is that I find, and this may be changing, I don't know, but I see fewer applicants from kind of the top medical schools doing away rotations. And though it's interesting because certainly you went to Northwestern, and it sounds like you saw, you know, some of your classmates do them, and that's obviously a great medical school. So it may be that that's changing. But in general, at least over the past few years, it seems like some percent of people doing away rotations are maybe trying to find an edge, maybe that they feel they don't have from the medical school they're coming from or something like that. And so I think it's all going to be a conversation, like you said, that needs to happen with a mentor who can look at your application, try to get a feel for how competitive you are. And then also, I think it needs to take into account what's your personality. And if you put all that together and the calculus says do an away rotation, it may help you quite a lot. Sometimes we think about people who really want to be anesthesiologists, but we worry about their competitiveness. And so some people we actually advise, you can apply, but you might want to dual apply. So who do we think should take that advice?
This is such an important question. The point that needs to be made at the beginning of my answer is that your best chance of matching, period, is your senior year of medical school. So the overall match rate for allopathic seniors is 93%. The overall match rate for DOs is 92%. You look at people who reapply a subsequent year, and those numbers have fallen to, you know, pretty much a flip of a coin. And so while I appreciate that people have specific intentions with their careers, they are very interested in a particular specialty, I think I would encourage people to look into dual applying if they are advised to do so by someone in their school. This should be a conversation that a mentor or a member of the dean's office is having with you before this time of year. Because the problem is if we get into the weeds of figuring out how to balance two applications right now, it's going to be difficult to do that before September without some planning. When I think about the type of people who should dual apply, we've already talked about step scores. Anyone with a major academic red flag, in my opinion, and this, you know, you're a program director, so you can let me know what you think. I think they should be having a conversation about dual applying. Unfortunately, my advice to DO students as well at this time, based on the conversations I've been having this year, which I'll give you an example. I had someone reach out to me because they've applied to greater than 30 away rotations. They do not have a home program. They do not have someone to write them a letter of recommendation who is an anesthesiologist. They are struggling to get into an OR to shadow. The resources just are not there. So unless you are a very well-resourced DO student with mentorship, with involvement in professional societies, you need to be having a conversation about dual applying. The nice thing about the field is that there are some adjacent career paths that you can take. You can do an emergency medicine residency and do a crit fellowship and end up in an anesthesia critical care environment. There is IM to palm crit. So there are a lot of really similar, if you're passionate about physiology and pharmacology, pathways you can take and still make sure that you are, you know, financially and professionally securing your future. I cannot in good conscience recommend to someone who has failed a step, has failed, you know, a clerkship, who is at this time of year still searching for an anesthesiology elective to do. I cannot in good conscience recommend to those people they do not think about dual applying. Also for those same groups, it's going to be very important how they choose to use their program signals, especially combining geographic with program signals to have the biggest oomph when their applications are reviewed by the residency application committees.
Yeah, I agree with that, everything you just said. I think that, so it can never hurt you to dual apply, but it's a nice backup. The other options are either you don't dual apply and you kind of accept the risk of not matching at all. The problem with that, as you said, is applying as a second time after being out, either whether you decide to do a research year and then apply again categorically, or whether you decide to scramble or soap into a prelim year and apply from there, is that your chances are much less and for a few reasons. One is that if you're looking for a spot that would start you right away, let's say you do a prelim year, you soap into a prelim year, you ideally don't want to repeat your intern year. So you're looking for what are called R spots. Those are spots that would start right away after the match. There are not many of them. So you just have a very low chance of getting one. On top of that, if you apply to regular spots, you're applying with that disadvantage of having, unfortunately, what is kind of a black mark on your record of having not matched once. And even if, you know, there were good, even if, let's just say you only applied to like one place, okay, and that's why you didn't match. Unfortunately, that's not going to be really salient and obvious. It's still going to have this question mark in people's minds of why didn't this person match the first time. It's not impossible, but as you said, just looking at the data, the chances are significantly less. And so the last thing I'll say is there are some medical schools who allow people who don't match to stay in medical school and do an additional year and then apply. I think that's, I had actually never heard of that before. I met some people who were doing it. I think it's, if you have the option, I think it's a better choice than soaping into a prelim year because you're then at least applying as a student, but it's still not ideal. So you want to maximize your chances of matching into something, as you said, and I think it can't hurt you to dual apply. The last thing I'll say is that you might ask the question, is it a hindrance? Is it a problem if I dual apply to, let's say, you know, internal medicine and anesthesia in the same university, in the same school of medicine? Are they going to think, oh, they don't know which one they want to do? And I think these days, that's probably not an issue. I think that pretty much everyone would assume, at least on the anesthesiology side, that you want to do anesthesia and that you're applying as a backup. Not that, and listen, I'm not trying to, you know, speak poorly about internal medicine. You might well prefer internal medicine, but most people would not apply to anesthesiology as a backup these days. So I think that you're safe from that standpoint. And, you know, I kind of wouldn't worry about that. And I agree with you that, Tricia, that if anybody, if your step two score is low enough, and honestly, it's a little hard to know exactly what that means, but I would probably say that a step two score below 230 is almost a requirement that you dual apply. It's just these days, it's going to be very hard to match with a step two score below 230. Not impossible. I don't want people to hear this and think, that's it, I can't apply anesthesiology, but it's going to be hard. And I think if you want to maximize your chances of having something that you can match into, I would probably dual apply.
Yeah, our average matched step two score on our survey was 252. Our average unmatched score was 245. In your response, actually, you alluded to a very interesting phenomenon that I've tweeted about a little bit, which is anesthesiology used to be a backup specialty. Until very recently, we were the backup for ENT and ortho. And while the overall number of anesthesiology applicants between 2023 and 2024 largely remained the same, The percentage change or the difference in the number of anesthesiology applicants that also applied somewhere else decreased significantly, down by 77% in ENT, down by 53% in orthopedic surgeries. So whereas the number of people who are applying anesthesiology overall has not changed very much, the percentage of those applicants who want to do anesthesiology first is much higher than it was in previous years because we have become too risky to be a backup. And I think that's also part of the issue where people are trying to figure out what exactly went wrong with their mentees not matching and wondering, well, they didn't have any red flags. The number of applicants didn't change very much. It's because the pool is now filled with people who only want to do anesthesiology.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Thanks for pointing that out. So one of the really key things here, as you mentioned a little bit, is signals. Those are, other than your step two score, you know, where you signal, maybe more than your step two score, honestly, because your chances of, well, we will hear what you found here, what we found in the data, but we have a similar program director survey that went out that showed that, at least among responding programs, if you didn't signal a program at all, your chances of getting an interview were less than 3%. And I think our survey showed even less, right? That students found it was like 1% or something like that if they didn't. I can't remember exactly, Tricia, but you'll tell us. But anyway, very unlikely. So signaling is super important. But to do that, students have to be able to assess their own competitiveness in order to decide how to use their signal. So how can students do that?
It's with help. Please seek out a mentor who can review your application. Someone who has been ideally involved in residency applicant selection recently, because it is almost impossible as an anesthesiology applicant, as any applicant, to accurately self-assess because we just simply don't have the background knowledge. It's an incredibly difficult process because you're going through it, investing thousands of dollars, being asked to choose program signals wisely, and we don't have the necessary information. And I will say, this is my plea for all programs to be more transparent about minimum, you know, step scores or minimum class rankings or things like that, because applicants need data to be able to make informed decisions. We've already said it, but it's worth repeating. The components you must take into account when evaluating your own competitiveness is presence or absence of academic red flags. So this is not just, you know, oh, a borderline step two score. This is, did you fail a clerkship? Did you fail, you know, an exam that's going to show up on your dean's letter? And then objective metrics of academic performance, be it step two, be it your clerkship scores, every school kind of does it differently, whatever the potpourri of academic assessment you have at your institution. Unfortunately, institutional rank and sort of recognition is important. You're going to have more opportunities as a student from a top five, top 20 program than students who are from other schools. That is a component of it. And then the quality and the length and the investment into your activities is so important. And you can speak to this as well, but some of the advice that I give to medical students over and over about what should I do to put on my resume to make it seem like I'm really interested in anesthesiology, pick something that you're truly passionate about. Get involved in a committee and stay there for 2-3 years. Did you do that, or did you, you know, kind of bounce around between student groups? And then finally, research. So this used to be a specialty where research was not, it was very optional. It was not required. Anyone who's interested in anesthesiology these days, I don't think they need to do anesthesiology research specifically. Frankly, there's not enough opportunities for medical students who want to go into the field to do anesthesiology specific research. But you can make an argument for almost any organ system, any research related to perioperative care of patients, to, you know, cardiopulmonary physiology. There are so many ways to connect a research project to the field of anesthesiology. And we are moving towards a point where it is going to be, it is probably now a prerequisite to a successful application. With respect to our survey data, so our matched applicants on average received 4 interviews from programs they sent a gold signal to, compared to 2 for unmatched applicants. And so probably two different things are happening. One is those matched applicants are better resourced, they have better mentorship, and they are choosing those programs more wisely. as well as they probably had better statistics and, you know, a more complete resume. Whereas the unmatched applicants were maybe not using their program signals accurately. Perhaps they were using them aspirationally versus sending them to programs that they felt like would interview them. And then to your point about places that were not signaled, both groups on average only received one interview from a program they did not send a signal to and sent in, you know, 70 applications on average. So the percentage yield is so low, and I think we are going to see the total number of applications coming down over the coming years. However, I think the total number of interviews for the matched applicant is going to be close to 15 because that's what our program signals are at, and my understanding is where they're staying.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, and we're back, and we're talking about the number of signals. Yeah, you're exactly right. So we're keeping it at 5 gold and 10 silver for this year in many ways so that we have some consistency, so that people actually can understand what's going on, but also so that we can gather data from more than just 1 year and see what it looks like and whether we think we need to make a change in future years. I'll echo a few things that you said. One is that it's so crucial to have mentors, advisors who can help you. I will say that sometimes you want to make sure it's someone who can be dispassionate, because if it's someone who's just going to tell you that you're great because they like you and they don't want to hurt your feelings, that could be a huge problem. So just for example, if you have a 225 on step two and you've got an advisor telling you that you're an amazing applicant because you've done some amazing activities and you've been really impactful in your community, I would say they're right that you're a wonderful person, but they're wrong that you're going to be a competitive applicant. And so you would need to think not only about sending your signals to pretty places that you think are less competitive, but also you need to think about dual applying. So that's the easiest one. I think, you know, a relatively low step two score is kind of easy. You should think of yourself as not very competitive. If it's, you know, in the mid-range, so I think that of the mid-range as being probably like 240 to 250, you know, that's probably not hurting you a lot, but it's probably not helping you a huge amount. And I think once you start getting over 250, and certainly if you're in the 260 and above, I think that's helping you quite a bit. But that's the easy one because it's a number. Beyond that, I think it's tough. And that's where you have to sit down with an advisor and kind of look at what you've done and look at your research. You're absolutely right. I think most program directors, if not all, agree it doesn't have to be anesthesia research, but research is helpful. So I think all of that's really important. And then when you're doing those signals, right, like you just have to really think hard. It is, I think if you're in that low end, again, let's just use the easy one. If your step two score is 230, I think you want to send your 5 gold signals to places that you really think are likely to take less competitive applicants. We'll talk in a bit about how you figure that out, because I think that can be tough. If you're in the step two score of 240 to 250, I think you can split them. Maybe you send 2 or 3 to, you know, kind of aspirational programs. You send 2 or 3 to more less aspirational programs. And then if you're, you know, above 260, above 250 and certainly above 260, I think then you can probably, again, this is assuming all the other stuff kind of fits with that, but I think then you can send your 5 signals to aspirational programs and the best ones that you want to apply to.
Yeah.
Okay. So now when you're thinking about your signals, the other thing that comes up is geographic signals. So how should people think about using those? Should they combine them? Should they not? What do you think, Patricia?
I will tell you what I did now that I am successfully matched and can reveal my secrets. I did not think about geographic signals until I had figured out where my program signals were going. I only had 5. So 2 years ago, we only had 5. And then I looked at the geographic distribution of where the other programs I was applying to that I had not signaled. And I added up the geographic regions that had the highest number of programs, and I signaled those geographic regions. And they ended up being the Midwest, which made sense for me. I was based in Chicago, and the Northeast, and then I think somewhere in the South. So I didn't touch my geographic signals until I decided which programs I was going to send a signal to, because all of the data I have read suggests that the most impactful signaling choice is to combine geographic and program signals together. That's what has the biggest oomph. There is an argument to be made for signaling your home sort of region. There, and you can combine all of that together, right? So you can signal programs in your home region. You can signal the geographic region you are based in, and then you can physically be from that region. And those three factors together are going to make a very compelling argument to residency programs. Hey, I'm from here. I'd like to stay here, and I'd like to do it at your program. And I think those factors together are going to optimize your chances. If you are someone who is in this mid-range competitiveness or low-range competitiveness, you must do that. I would strongly recommend if you are going to apply to anesthesiology, you should have the combination of geographic program and your physical presence signaling together to tell programs that's where you want to be. Not doing that is a missed opportunity to make an argument to programs that you want to train at their institution. And then there's, of course, the question of, oh, I want to transition across the country, right? My family's on the other side of the country. My significant other's on the other side of the country. Do not take my advice and then ignore those factors for yourself. If you have people you love that you need to be with, use a geographic signal to tell programs, this is what's important to me. And you have the opportunity to justify why you're using those signals. So there's going to be a small blurb that you get to write where you can say, I'm based in Chicago, but my husband lives in Portland, Oregon, and I really want to move to the Pacific Northwest. It's very important to me. You can communicate that to programs. So take into account the strategy, of course, but please also don't discount the very real emotional impact of being away from people who love you and know you and can take care of you during residency.
Yep, absolutely. And a few things. So one is that the data from ERAS from last cycle was that if you gold signaled and geographic signaled, as you just said, Tricia, that was your maximum chance of getting an interview, and it was something like 60%. If you silver signaled and geographic signaled, then it was less, but something like 40%. If you gold signaled or silver signaled and did not geographic signal, it dropped you a little bit, but not that much. So maybe went from 60 to 50 and 40 to 30 or something like that. If you did not signal, if you did not program signal, then it whether or not you geographic signaled, your chances were less than 3%. So it is, as you said, to maximize your chances, have those aligned. Now, I will say what I tell people is exactly what you did. First, decide where you want to send your signals. And then see if you can fit them all into three regions. And if you can, great. Then you're done. You can just geographic signal those three regions. If you can't, if you really feel like your 15 programs you're going to signal are just in five or six regions around the country, then I would suggest one of two options. Either you pick your top programs and pick the three regions therein, knowing that you're going to disadvantage yourself in the programs that you aren't able to geographic signal. Or you can check the box that says decline to geographic signal. And then in the little paragraph, which you're allowed to write, don't decline to write the paragraph. Write in there something like, I am happy to go anywhere in the country. I'm just looking for the best training program for me. And if that is, and there's any region that's in, I'm happy to move to. I have nothing tying me to where I am now. And so that's why I did not do geographic signals. If you just say no geographic signals, you don't put anything. Or if you do signal, but you leave some regions out that you're sending program signals to, that's going to potentially hurt you.
Right. And it's very,
I think that's
the very, very competitive specialties like neurosurgery and orthopedic surgery. They use geographic signals at lower rates than some of the other specialties. I think for the argument that you're making where they don't want to be tied down to any particular part of the country. And I'm wondering if maybe anesthesiology is heading in that direction potentially in the next couple of years. But for now, I did exactly what you disadvised people to do, which was interesting. And yes, the decline to signal should include some context.
100%. The other thing everyone should know, and this is something you might not get if you don't have good advising, is that a lot of people, even in the era of program and geographic signaling, are still doing a personalized personal statement, where in that personal statement, they're writing a different one for every program. And they are saying, now it's mostly the same, but in the last paragraph or somewhere in there, usually the last paragraph, they are saying why they are interested in that specific program. And, I hate to put more work on applicants, but I do think that if you want to maximize your chances, you should do this because other people are doing it. And so I think that it makes sense. I don't think you need to do it beyond your signals, because you're probably not going to get interviews there anyway. But at the 15 places you're going to signal, you probably should do this. And this would be another place to say what you mentioned, Tricia, which would be to say, my husband lives in Portland. I really want to be there. Because that's one big thing, is that if you're training on the East Coast, even if you send a program signal to the West Coast, they're going to be a little skeptical, right? Are you really going to move all the way across the country when you've spent the last 4 years on the, 3,000 miles away? And if you can give them a good reason, like I have family there, my spouse is there, et cetera, that's very compelling and it certainly won't hurt. So I would highly encourage people to do that.
I did that actually. It was only 5 programs when I did it, but the last paragraph of your personal statement should be sort of a wish list for what you're looking for in your training program. That's what I was told. Or what you're looking forward to in your career, what you're looking forward to in residency, something that sort of opens the door to let, you walk through into a conversation in your interview. So it's really not too much work to change that, to reflect the goals and values and mission of the residency programs that you're applying to, which you can easily obtain from a program's website, or even better, by having a conversation with a resident currently at that program. You can quite easily find us. We're floating around on social media. And if you can have a 5 to 10 minute conversation and say, hey, what is your experience at University of Michigan? Or, what does your program director at Johns Hopkins really, really care about now? Applicants. It can be incredibly informative. And just that last paragraph honestly writes itself.
Absolutely. And, you can say that in there. You can say, when I spoke to Dr. Pendergrast, we had a great conversation. And the things she told me, X, Y, and Z, made me think Michigan was a wonderful place that I would really thrive in. Now, don't do that unless you actually talk to Dr. Pendergrast, because if I'm the program director, I'm going to call up Tricia and say, hey, I heard you talk to so-and-so, right? And if she says, I don't know who that is, then that's a huge problem. Yeah. So if you do it, then you can absolutely include that in that paragraph.
And assign those personal statements and recheck it 3 or 4 times, because nothing is going to sink you faster than sending your, University of Illinois personal statement to University of Chicago. Please do not make that mistake. Get an extra pair of eyes on every part of your application, not just that one, but that and letters of recommendation and your rank list. All of those things need to be checked and double checked.
100%. And not just for that reason, that would be a huge problem if you sent the wrong paragraph to the wrong school, but even typos. I mean, this is such a crucial thing in your career. And if you can't spend the time to double check it and have other people double check it to make sure there are no grammatical mistakes or typos in that personal statement, that's a real concern. Not because a typo is such a horrible crime, but because what does it say about your thoroughness, right? And we certainly have to be thorough and careful in anesthesiology. So that is just such an easy thing to avoid by having, as you just said, multiple sets of eyes go through it and look for any kind of grammatical mistake or spelling error or anything. So you just don't let that be the thing that sinks you. All right. So you mentioned before, but let's just revisit it. Tricia, what specific advice do you have for students without home programs, but who are really still hoping to be able to become anesthesiologists?
The first thing I want to say is that it is doable. It is doable. There are DOs in my program, and we are highly ranked. We are a great program. There, it's 100% possible. So that's where I want to start. The second thing I'll say is early mentorship, early involvement is going to be key. So many of my answers, so many of your answers have involved mentorship, a second pair of eyes, a trusted advisor. And that's really what's lacking when you don't have a home program. I had the cell phone number of one of the APDs at Northwestern that was given to me, the summer before I applied. And he told us, text me with questions, and met with us multiple times and helped us strategize. So having someone who sits at the table, who helps make residency match decisions, giving you information about how the process works is, invaluable, truly. As early as possible, like I've already said, get involved with your state anesthesiology society, with the ASA medical student component, shadow an anesthesiologist. Maybe you don't have a home program. Get into the OR and be in that environment, be it with a physician anesthesiologist or a CRNA or someone who can just introduce you to that environment. So you can sort of speak to that when you look for away rotations. You must do some sort of clinical senior experience in anesthesiology. It is of the utmost importance. So your away rotation applications are going to be incredibly, incredibly important. And then also looking for research opportunities. I know they can be somewhat far and few between if you're not affiliated with an academic medical center. But again, getting involved with an anesthesiology society, maybe there is, excuse me, a interest society for you know, women in medicine, or, you know, a group that you identify with that can connect you with mentors to introduce you to research projects, you kind of have to get a little bit scrappy if you don't have that mentorship at your home institution, but it is 100% doable. And again, I will plug, social media is a great place to look for mentors. It has really become this environment where underrepresented groups in medicine go to either mentor or be mentor. So there are people in that environment who want to help, who want to facilitate your success. And then just being mindful of, you know, your competitiveness as you move forward to this part of the year. Please do not put yourself in a situation where you're going to be several hundred thousand dollars in debt, because all you can see is matching into anesthesiology and not the bigger picture. I don't like giving that advice to people, but at the end of the day, what I want is for everyone to, you know, be happy and financially secure. And sometimes you have to go a little bit of a security route to do that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I think it's much like romantic relationships, where some people believe that there's just one person, right? That they have to find the one. And if my wife is listening, that's absolutely true. And she's the one for me. Okay. But I actually think that that's not true. I think that there are lots of people for any one person who you could have a wonderful relationship with and marriage with and build a family with and have a wonderful life together. And I think it's the same, is that I am so happy in anesthesiology, but I do not think that if I had been in any other specialty, I would be miserable. I think that, you know, you can find interesting paths for yourself within a lot of different specialties and find ways to be happy. So, you know, I like you, I want people who want to do anesthesiology to be able to do it. And I hope for everyone to have success, but it's, we know it's not going to happen for everybody. And so don't think it's the be all end all, right? It is, you can 100% try, and you should, but if you can't do it, or if you just don't have the application that's likely to match, don't think that means that your life is ruined or you can't have a wonderful career in medicine, because you can. It just may not be as an anesthesiologist, and you never know where the path will take you. You probably will be able to find your way to happiness. And I would say that the biggest piece of advice I can give anyone who's kind of, you know, in a position where you might not match is, do not take it personally. This is not a reflection on who you are as a person in any way. It is simply the fact that there are too many people applying for not enough spots. And we have an imperfect system where we end up relying on things like a step two score, which have zero reflection of what kind of person you are, or even what kind of doctor you're going to be. But it is what it is. And so know that it isn't about you as a person. And to the extent you can, don't take it personally. Just think about this as a, you know, you can take a shot, and some people, it's going to work out for some and not for others. And that's okay. You can still have unlike things like, you know, I have a friend who's an opera singer, you know, or wanted to be a professional opera singer, and that's not going to happen, right? And it's not like she can be a different kind of professional musician, right? Like, you just, in music and in sports and in music, like, very few people actually get to be the thing. In medicine, chances are pretty good that if you want to be a practicing physician and you're in medical school right now, you'll be able to. It just may not be the exact type that you are hoping for. And that's, you know, I get that that's disappointing, but it's okay. I think you can still find happiness.
Yeah. And I think people arrive at that conclusion post soaping, or post, you know, and that's just, it's a horrendous process for people who are not familiar with it. Essentially, if you don't match, you're forced into this very quick microcosm of the entire residency match process in 3 days. And if you fail to secure a spot, then you can try to scramble into one. And the spots that have been open in the last several years are internal medicine, family medicine, emergency medicine, and some pediatrics. Those are the specialties that I would encourage people who are thinking about dual applying to dual apply into, along with anesthesiology. But you have a lot more agency if you arrive at the conclusion, hey, this might be a little bit of a gamble for me. The overall match rate was, you know, 60% for my type of degree last year. I'm going to apply into emergency medicine as well. Well, now you get to choose which programs you're applying to. You get to select the cities you're interested in. You get to program signal. You get to do all the things. Whereas if you go through the SOAP process, you might get, you know, thrown halfway across the country away from your support system to a program that you don't know that much about because you met them the day that they offered you a spot. So it's a much more favorable situation to put yourself into to dual apply versus SOAPing or scrambling. And then for those people who, you know, soap into a preliminary only spot, they then have to incur the cost of reapplying. And I think what we're going to see in the coming years is a backlog of anesthesiology applicants who did not match this year, who are reapplying into the specialty. And a lot of those folks are highly qualified, have big step scores, have a lot of research experience, and just maybe didn't use their program signals exactly how you should this past year. So it's just going to get more and more difficult to return to the application process and succeed at it.
Yeah, absolutely agree. The one thing I meant to say before also is for those folks who are looking for away rotations, I would advise you take step two as early as you can. I mean, make sure you have time to study and you feel good about your practice tests and you're going to be able to perform well. But a lot of places are waiting to give out away rotations until they see your step two score because they don't have a step one score, right? So I would encourage you to think about trying to optimize your timing of that so that you can apply for away rotations with a step two score because that's going to help you get those away rotations.
Yep, absolutely. And for the M1s and M2s that are listening, step two, dedicated in general, it's not 6 weeks of studying. It needs to unfold over a period of months. That is how you succeed on exams. That is the conversation that my program just had with me about the basic, is that you do not do well when you cram. And so understanding that succeeding on those exams is necessary to successfully match, start thinking about your process, not 2 months before you take the test, but at the beginning of the year before, and that will set you up for success.
Yeah, 100%. All right. So, Tricia, we've talked a lot about how to assess your own competitiveness. But once an applicant has a feel for that, they need to decide which programs to apply to based on how competitive that program is. Now, as I said before, this is very difficult to do. Do you have any thoughts on how people can go about this? I guess it's easy if you think you're, if you have determined that you are an incredibly competitive applicant, because then you can apply anywhere you want. But it's more if you have decided, well, I think I'm maybe middle of the road, or I think I may even be like not that competitive. How do you then decide where to send your signals? How do you figure out which programs are kind of the right fit?
This is the question. This is the question of strategy for residency applicants, not just for the field of anesthesiology, but for every field. And I've already said this, but I'll say it again. I think this is where people went wrong this last application cycle. I think program signals were misused, and that's why qualified applicants did not match. There are really two resources that you can use to evaluate a program's competitiveness. One is going to be the objective metrics. So what are they ranked? We know U.S. News and World Report rankings are sort of falling out of favor. They still give you kind of an idea of the tier of institution you're at. You can look at research dollars. Not only does that tell you about sort of a ranking of a program, it also tells you about the identity of a program. So is this a program that is very research heavy? Are they looking for residents to be involved in research? If you don't have a ton on your CV, they're probably not going to be as interested in you compared to other applicants. And while you might be academically on par with that institution, it might not be the right fit. Whereas there might be institutions that heavily favor resident involvement in community service, going to community, surgical sites, getting out and doing private practice rotations without favoring research. So you also have to evaluate the identity of a program alongside the competitiveness or the institutional ranking. You also must, and I know I'm sounding like a broken record at this point, have conversations with people who are in the field about these institutions. I've found that people who are in the cities where there are a lot of institutions tend to know the identities of those institutions quite well. So I, as someone who went to medical school at Northwestern, who interviewed with the Chicago programs, who has a professional network in Chicago, I can tell you quite a lot about the anesthesiology residencies in Chicago. I interviewed there. I didn't train there, obviously, but people in cities tend to know those institutions well. You also must have conversations with residents. I would encourage anyone, at least for the gold signals, please find someone who is boots on the ground, who can tell you about their experiences at a program, where they feel like the department is heading. And this is getting sort of away from objective, rankings of programs and more about what your quality of life is going to be and if they're enjoying their experience, which is, while perhaps not as important when it comes to fellowship match and beyond, is incredibly important for your day-to-day life and your well-being in residency. But I would look at both. I would look at these objective metrics of rankings and research dollars and where the department appears to be allocating its resources, but also have conversations with your mentors, because they'll be able to say, oh, that's a really strong program, or that's a really strong program in cardiac anesthesiology, but not so much obstetric anesthesiology. And if you want to be an obstetric anesthesiologist, that's not the program for you. And then again, we'll reiterate that it's very important for these goal programs to talk to someone who is there and going through the process. Do they like their program director? Do they feel like they can go to them with problems? Do they like the faculty? What's the relationship like with other anesthesiology providers at the institution? Do they feel like they're supported when they're studying? All these questions are so important, but they're not going to be found on a website. And that helps you decide where to send your signals, because it's partially about, you know, your professional future, but also your day-to-day life. And when you're working 65 hours a week, the latter is going to feel a little bit more important until you're looking for a job.
Completely agree. And I agree with everything you just said. And I will say that I want to emphasize, if you ask enough people in anesthesia, you'll probably get a pretty good feel. If you say, hey, I'm thinking about these programs, do you have a feel for how prestigious, competitive you think these programs are? Most people in anesthesiology, especially younger people who have matched recently, because people who have been in practice for 20 years, it may have been different 20 years ago, right? They may or may not have. But I think most people in academics, and certainly most people who have matched recently, are going to be able to help you with that. So ask around. And, you know, again, I'm no expert, but I bet social media is another place you could kind of try to float that, whether it's by specifically finding someone you could ask separately, or even maybe by just putting it out there as, you know, hey, can someone help me with thinking about competitive programs versus not? I don't know that, I guess that to me feels like maybe people wouldn't necessarily put that out publicly, but they probably would say, you know, let's talk privately and I'll give you some ideas.
Yeah. I mean, just go to the residency Instagram or Twitter. And what I did, and I did this for my gold signals, because I signaled Cleveland Clinic. I didn't know anyone there. And I wanted to know more about the program. So I went to their Twitter page. I found a resident and I sent him a message and asked if I could have a 10-minute conversation with him on the phone about his experience there. And it helped me make a decision about whether or not I wanted to send a program signal just by going through that simple process. I know if you look on our Michigan Anesthesiology Residency Twitter, it's not difficult to track some of us down. And I think it's a red flag if anyone is hesitant to have a conversation with you or cannot find the time to have a conversation with a prospective applicant. That is says a lot about the state of their education and engagement in their institution.
Completely agree. Tricia, is there anything we covered? So much good stuff. Anything we didn't cover that you want to get out there before we end?
Oh, wow. It's such an interesting time to be having this conversation. I'm so glad we're recording this. I hope it's helpful to mentors and applicants, because, this is the word of caution I want to put out there. The advice that rang true even 2 years ago, even when I was an applicant, you know, two cycles ago, is not necessarily true anymore. And when we have conversations amongst ourselves as, you know, residents and as faculty and with our mentees, we owe it to them to be informed and accurate and, you know, invested in helping them get their best foot forward in this process, because it is expensive, it is stressful, and their entire professional future is contingent on its success. So I appreciate anyone who is listening today, and I am happy to be a resource to applicants or, you know, faculty with questions about our data. We'll be putting out our paper soon, alike if they have, you know, other issues that we did not address from our conversation.
Fabulous. All right, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Tricia, what do you recommend people check out for fun?
For fun? It's not necessarily a resource, but I've been very into baking chocolate chip cookies lately. And I would like to encourage anyone who makes chocolate chip cookies on a regular basis to brown their butter before making the cookies. I think it completely changes your experience and goes really good with a cup of coffee.
I could not agree more. I think the best chocolate chip cookies and the best chocolate chip cookie dough are with browned butter. The problem for me is that the dough is so good, I end up eating most of it before I bake the cookies. But browned butter, my favorite recipe involving brown butter is from Serious Eats, which is they use the what's it called? Not the Idea Lab. I'm blanking on the name. Do you know what it is? It's the, anyway, if you go to Serious Eats and look up their brown butter chocolate chip cookie recipe, that is absolutely fabulous. I just made it.
I made a bourbon brown butter chocolate chip cookie like 2 hours ago. I'll have to send you the link for that.
Yes, please do. And I will put the, if you send me that, I can put it in the show notes. And I'll also put the link to the Serious Eats one. My recommendation is for a Netflix show that I just binge watched. I was on a couple of planes recently. I had seen season one of Full Swing. I think I shouted that out earlier in maybe a year ago. It's a Netflix kind of documentary series about professional golf. And they just, maybe not just, I just noticed that that season two was out. And it's very, very good if you're at all interested in golf. So check it out. It's called Full Swing season two on Netflix. All right, Tricia, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Are you looking for legit ways to make extra money? Our friends at The Side Hustle Show have put together this cool free 60-second quiz to help you do just that. All you got to do is go to hustle.show. You can do it right from your phone. Answer a few short multiple choice questions, and it'll recommend a few episodes of the hit Side Hustle Show podcast to start with. You can add your personalized Side Hustle Show playlist to your device, learn what works, and start making more money today. Again, that's at hustle.show or follow the award-winning Side Hustle Show in your favorite podcast app.
Plan on flying? In order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID. Learn how to get your real ID today at tsa.gov/real ID or visit your local DMV.